Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who, when we're on form, make programs that the human physiology is not equipped to bear the pleasure of. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
Sucked all sort for this one.
We're learning all about population control from Helen A. It's the Happiness Patrol.
So, of course, you realise this isn't completely the wrong podcast order. It's meant to be the fourth of the series.
I know.
You know what? The badge. If any of you want to argue, the badge.
Well, I actually suggested that there was a big Finnish spin-off series called The Earring Chronicles that explains how Flower Child's earring gets on Sophie's thing in Silver Nemesis.
Don't say that loud, because there'll be four series of four stories each.
You just need to say it three times. Yeah. The Earring Chronicles, The Earring Chronicles, The Earring Chronicles. Wow, it exists. Check out bigfinish.com.
With Jacqueline Pierce as the earring.
Briggs is everyone else.
Actually, this seems like a good a time as any to discuss the proposed order of stories. So, Remembrance of the Daleks was meant to start the season, followed by Greatest Show in the Galaxy.
Followed by Silver.
Silver Nemesis, followed by this. And what scuppered that was coverage of the Olympics, which pushed...
Seoul Olympics, yes.
Yep, which pushed Doctor Who's broadcast back by 1 week. JNT still wanted Silver Nemesis to start on the 23rd of November, meaning, with Remembrance going first... and Silver Nemesis having to start on that date, there was only a 3-week slot available. So Happiness Patrol had to go in there. Greatest Show had to go last, which we'll discuss that continuity terror later in the season. Terrible. But yes, here we have a three-part story, the studio-based three-parter, again directed by Chris Clough.
Chris Jimmel Clough. I really love the Australian broadcast, if we can all just talk about our youth again. When we first saw this...
What's his name? Sorry,
we had we were name checking Andrew Hodgson all through this. Not Stephen, what's his face? Because he almost gets on the radio. Even though we've been doing this before, you were even fetally engaged, Stephen.
We love you, Richard Maynard, yes. But we love you.
It's not going on the cutting room floor. It was a really lovely order for the show because. We haven't got there yet, but the almost final scene of this story would have been an extraordinary going out.
Happiness will Doctor. Prevail.
No, Helen A. and Fifi.
Oh, yes, God.
Jumping ahead. Imagine that as the very final moment of this season. That would have said a lot.
It's actually just about my favourite scene of the classic era. It really, really is extraordinary. And I... was tearing up watching it when we'd live tweeted.
You've had personal experience because you're savage, marauding hounds.
You know. That's it. Like, does the dog die.com, which is a website you can go to check whether the dog in a film dies so that you can.
They've already covered the reboot of K-9 voiced by John Leeson, haven't they?
Not to give anything away,
it's dead by the first episode.
And obviously Mark of the Rani.
And obviously Marley and Me just comes with, no, why are you even considering this?
Well, a dog's purpose where a whole bunch of dogs die one after the other, spoiler alert.
K-9 and company.
But I just think it's amazingly, brilliantly beautiful and a story that had been really political. Becomes really personal. It becomes about this one woman's, inability to properly understand about the relationship between love and grief, that you can't love someone without paying for it, that every relationship ends and grief is part of the process of loving anything. You know, it's a stupid puppet. The puppet is hilarious, like fabulously funny.
I think it's really good.
It is a good puppet.
It's good for the time, you know.
Oh, it's still good. It's just not well lit, but they've still got this thing quite dark, considering.
I would not say that the puppetry and the never-ending story, which had multi-millions of dollars poured into it, was that much better.
Soon we're working on that as well.
Yeah.
There are some great snarls where where Fifi bares its teeth at the end of a scene and growls. And, like, I think it's really super funny and having her, you know, Fifi's been eating far too many chockies lately.
It's based on Nigel Lawson, isn't it?
It's, I mean, it's,
I wonder his daughter is obsessed with sweetie things after this, yeah.
But it really is extremely beautiful, I think. And the music, like Dominic Glynn's music, just sells it.
Oh,
and then
thank
the,
you. Yeah,
the
can we go with that?
Pulls up from – it's a beautiful shot composition with her crying and Sylvester and Sophie watching her.
And what's wonderful about that music, again, it's Dominic Glynn, and I'm going to say this every time we mention Dominic Glynn. Dominic, thank you for allowing us to use your music in Time Incorporated. But
what a zinger of a story.
But the thing is that – sort of crescendo of music has been fed all the way through the story. It's tunes Earl is playing. There's little tiny bits of it throughout, and then it just becomes this big thing. I love Sophie's reaction, or rather Ace's reaction to Helen A crying. She genuinely looks sorry for her, like, Professor, can't we do anything for this horrible dictator who's murdered
over half a million people, if the census is to be believed.
Exactly. And
we had Pinochet and Ceausescu doing exactly the same thing at the time. But, and Thatcher, in fact, by selling, you know, at the beginning of the arms, the reason that Britain's money went up was not because she fired every single miner and every working class man. It's because she was nicely flirting with every Saudi prince she could find and flogging him every bit of tax she could get her hands on.
Not only that, but the suppression of public grief from a certain sector of the community.
Ah, and we will be touching on that later on. Before we get to that, can we stay with exposition and the construction of this story and the major influence of this little film? Because it actually is a film in three parts. Dominic Glynn is a big fan of Sir Carol Reed and Orson Welles. And Sir Carol Reed's a big fan of a certain period of German filmmaking. And there's an extraordinary film called The Third Man with Orson Welles right at the very end. It's mostly Joseph Cotten wandering around trying to find Orson Welles. Have you watched it? It's on Stan. You can see it for nothing. It's a gorgeous film. It's film noir at Britain's greatest with the zither music. So it's got that lovely Hungarian kind of beautiful. It's all filmed around Budapest. But both Chris Clough and Dominic and everyone else said, we want to do this as a remake of the Third Man, and we want to shoot it in black and white. Have a look. There's an image that we'll put up at the very first moment when you get the actress who's been in everything.
Daphne Oxenbould.
That's the one as a Killjoy. And it's almost it's beautiful, but it is almost a frame from the use of the crane sort of does come from a certain period of German.
And, yeah, we don't often see crane shots for dramatic scenes in Doctor Who. They're
expensive, too.
Yeah, because, there was a lot in the early 80s Doctor Who, season 18, Peter's seasons, where the crane would be used to sort of show off the main set the first time we see it.
And cleavage, generally.
But here,
ask
you know.
Ask Janet, she'll tell you.
Here, you know, we do get that a few times, and there is lots of what are known as Dutch tilts or Batman angles with the frame being tilted. What I noticed when I was last watching it is, they weren't allowed to shoot it in black and white as they'd hoped, but the set design is still very monochrome.
But did you notice they've actually painted the sets in only greys? So the only things that are coloured are the characters and the items.
And just occasional bits of pink and yellow. Everything's pink and yellow, with the exception of things in the candy kitchen.
And the planet.
And the planet's pink and yellow. Exactly.
Pink and yellow.
But it's incredibly effective, and it sort of shows what Frank Miller was doing in comic books, for instance.
Yeah, Batman Year One.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. You know,
Batman killing Joke at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah, sort of not exactly monochrome, but strong use of individual colours to draw the eye within the frame. And that's what happens here. And I think it really helps that Sophie's costume is mostly black and Sylvester's costume is mostly yellows or shades of yellow. There are reds in there, but, you know, he's got a cream jacket, he's got his yellow pullover and his brown check trousers. So they fit in as well.
Can you imagine if this had been Perry and Sixie? And we can say Sixie because you know who coined that term?
Colin Baker.
So, no, not in my presence.
Did he really did? He calls himself that every bloody interview he horrific. Does.
Though. Deal with it, Nathan.
I can't see how this story would have worked with the previous.
No,
they would, knockabout.
They would have shot Perry on the spot, the Happiness Patrol.
But it wouldn't have worked.
That's a massive strontium 90 of whining right there, isn't it? Yeah.
He's too big. He attracts too much attention to himself. And this is a story where the Doctor lurks like Troughton, quietly working to overthrow the government.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of him just going from place to place. And setting things sort
which
of
is
gradually
what happens
in motion.
In the third man. Yeah.
Yeah. And something else this reminds me of in terms of Doctor Who is actually the Sunmakers. Yeah.
Well, it's funny that because Sunmakers influenced a lot of comics, certainly Judge Dredd and the writers, you know, nodded to Doctor Who of that era. Mm. Sunmakers, Judge Dredd, 2000 AD, this lot, well, Cartmel. It's just, it's comfortably full circle.
Mm. I think it's a tradition. Which is started by the Savages, actually, where the Doctor comes to a society that is set up to illustrate political oppression in some way, society that's characteristics work on a sort of allegorical level, and he overthrows it in one night. And that's very definitely his mission when he arrives. It's the beginning of a night. Mm-hmm. It all takes place over the course of one single night. And by the end of the story, he's overthrown the government. I think The Savages does it beautifully.
Beautifully. That's another one we were going to talk about as being an antecedent of this. Yes.
Yeah, well, I think so. It's a society where, you know, allegorically a group of people are sucking the life out of another group of people in order to prosper. So it's about imperialism.
Or the convention circuit.
Or the convention circuit. And this one, the happiness thing, where unhappiness is a code for political dissent, the idea of disagreeing, of being unhappy with the status quo is criminalized. There's
right at the point of Section 28.
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. So this is Andrew Cartmell attempting to fulfill his initial aim, which is to overthrow Thatcher's government by having Helen A, who is clearly Thatcher. She's... Yeah. Practiced media kind
yes.
of performance.
Some of the lines, one of the ones they cut out, and how about Sheila Hancock, who's since gone on to completely vault face, but at the time was so with it with this narrative and the idea of it.
She's wonderful, isn't
it? I think she's superb and perfectly cast and really bites the part, doesn't she? She really, my favourite. No, she really gets in there.
I think we spent months and months just quoting lines from this to each other all the time.
We really did.
Strawberry, madam. You know, it's really, really tremendous. And it does have some other antecedents in things like there's a Monty Python story about Happy Valley where Wise King Otto had all of the unhappy people put to death many years earlier along with the trade union leaders. And,
of course, and that's right.
Anyone with any personal problems would be prosecuted under the Happiness Act.
Doctor Who hasn't been this of the now, this with it and down with the kids, since the 60s. This is really happening. Okay, Pertwee's era did... visually and with Joe Grant, but Pertwee himself was always establishment, however much you want to say the opposite. He was kindly noblesse oblige Tory.
Yeah.
We've now got a proper working class Troughton, as you say, Doctor Who's getting underneath. How could this not have been happening all the time? I sort of wondered, this is what Doctor Who is supposed to do.
It's surprising because neither Saywood nor John Nathan Turner wanted to be political in Doctor Who.
Well, we know that JNT was actively apolitical because he was terrified, not for his own job, he wanted to get out, as we know, and in fact already announced that this was his last, if ever, but that they knew that the program would be stopped because just like the current Australian Broadcasting Commissariat that we've got right now, it's so loaded with Tory thinking that anything you voice is going to bring wrath.
Yeah, and it's constantly under pressure because it's publicly funded and you've got a conservative government that doesn't agree with providing services in exchange for tax money.
What this show is talking about is we've got a dogmatic, repressive government that's elected by half-hearted people who simply want a quiet life and want a stern teacher, I'm looking at Nathan when I say this, to sort things out for them.
Mm.
And look what that gets you. World.
Yeah, death squads.
This was a Britain that's actually turned against itself knowingly and willingly. And I think that's what this story is all about. Yeah, this is a Britain that's actually said, including the working classes, it's every class. I think we've got to get rid of that word and just say, start using people, or we're never going to get anywhere. It's turned against itself, and proportionately it's middle classes as well, so that Tory voters could pay less income tax themselves. Mm. It was a real US thinking. We talk about this as being a post-Harvard School of Economics rationalization in this neocon world that we're in now, but it was actually very English. Thatcher developed this and took this along. This, what we used to call Reaganomics at the time, yeah, this went out.
Yeah.
But it became a very British thing, and it was really about, we forget this now, and Brendan, you were too young, but it was actually about lowering personal income tax. Look what happens.
Yeah.
You get women walking around with toilet roll doily covers on their heads and massive choo-choo toy guns. I kind of like the guns.
The guns.
You can have frocks and guns together. It's all right.
It's super frock, isn't it? It's wonderfully frock. And in fact, I think part of the frocks and guns thing actually comes from this, because...
Well, you coined that term.
No.
No, you did, because it's our podcast.
Yes, okay. I invented the internet as well.
And post-it.
Human Nature, that was one of yours?
That was mine.
Yes. Dropped a piano on me, did it with brutal.
This is kind of the frocks and guns thing, because you've got that incredibly great scene, which will be referenced in next year's season, where Sylvester goes up and just talks to gun-wielding men out of shooting. And he does it by showing them that being a gun-wielding sniper isn't a particularly brave or macho thing. In fact, it's an expression of cowardice, and they can't look him in the eye and shoot him. And there's the other thing here too, where no one is happy. The Happiness Patrol is enforcing happiness across, you know, the entire society, but literally no one at all in the entire society is happy. Aww. And you've got political discontent, maybe Joseph C.
I made a pipe person noise then. I think the Candyman might be reasonably content.
Yeah, no, he's always angry at everyone.
Very grumpy.
I haven't even got to him yet. My favourite thing in one, you know, possibly this whole era as a villain.
Yeah, oh, I think he's terrific.
You know, there was that whole thing when he was conceived, that he was a normal-looking person, but all of a sudden he would take off his glasses and start chewing them, and then, you know, he'd accidentally chop off a finger and pick it up and eat it, and that would reveal he may look human, but he's actually made of candy. And it's like, I think it was John Nathan Turner who insisted, no, I would like a literal impression. And I think it's a great idea, because it's giving us the Doctor Who monster thing, and it's giving us something...
So Nathan's happy.
But something normal... sweets
become
something sinister.
You know, this has an antecedent though, because this is what I do. There's Umpty Candy in 2000 AD.
Uh-huh.
Is it Judge Dredd? Umpty Candy is the product that they use that's so sweet that many humans can't digest it and live. It's their take on drugs. And
right.
Yeah. It's directly from that. But that's okay, because it's of the now.
Mm. And it's Doctor Who being stupid. There must have been lots of fanboys who are utterly horrified by the scenes where the Doctor sticks the Candyman's marshmallow feet to the floor by pouring lemonade on it, because it's silly. And we've had years and years of space corridors and aliens, and Doctor Who is proper serious science fiction. And thank God our long national nightmare of that is over.
But look, as a seven-year-old, I thought that was so clever, and I understood it because, and this is going to sound stupid, but the things you remember as a kid, something I remember as a kid is every time I got in the bath, the soap would be stuck to the bloody dish again.
That's gorgeous. And clean.
And clean. But I would have to, you know, there was a certain amount of water you had to use to get the soap off the thing.
Yeah.
So the idea that...
The thing. Okay, it's not quite so clean.
Lemonade would stick the Candyman to the floor.
Your word?
That's my word. Okay. Plus, of course, my mum was a chemist.
Mine's haberdashery. But come on.
And my dad was a histologist. So, you know, there was a lot of science in the house, a lot of science books. So and I understood chemical reactions.
Yes.
But that also taught me that idea. And
not to press your little self against the enamel bathtub for too long, because you have to put yourself back off again.
Right.
That's a mental picture for every listener.
It's getting back to, like, the Hartnell thing, where he discusses how light refraction works, how phosphorescence works. But it's just done in a really simple way that is relevant to the story. And quite frankly, if people think that it is silly, don't get me wrong, a man made of sweets, a robot made of sweets is silly.
Susan but will need the Skorovian plunger again. I've adhered to the TARDIS. Why am I channeling Alpha Centauri? Actually,
I'm stuck in the bath again.
that hexapod could have had some real moments as well, couldn't she?
But, you know, it's a question of is something too silly for Doctor Who, and very little is too silly for Doctor Who.
Not if it's really, really plumb dark at the same time. This is the darkest Doctor Who's ever done, and The Savages comes very close.
Well, I don't think that we've ever had a villain that has literally killed 500,000 people. Mm. She's controlled the population down by 17%, and Trevor Sigma, which is, again, another great character, has been counting the people who've disappeared, and it comes in, it's just below 500,000 at the start of the story and just above it by the end.
And he's there every 6 months. It's not 6 years. Actually say that. You think it's 6 years. No, it's 6 months. Yeah. So, yeah, she's really getting in there.
And you get that amazing moment where Trevor Sigma says to the Doctor, this is the name of the list of the people who've disappeared, and the Doctor takes it and throws it across the square. You know, it's not on an iPad, and we're not scrolling through it. We get that very visual representation of this is how many people are dead.
Do you know that the title of this was Crooked Smile, but as everybody in Cartmel says, it was always going to be Happiness Patrol, because you know that what that was a take on? Joy Division. Now, we all know Joy Division as being the Ian Curtis Northern band that was actually freaking miserable. And then after Curtis took his own life, it became New Order. You know where they got the title of Joy Division and indeed New Order? Joy Division, if you translate directly to the German, was the name of the officers given to the female internees in Nazi concentration camps who were used as sex slaves by the officers. That's how dark this show is.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, you get that line from, we've got Leslie Dunlop back. You get that line from Susan.
Mrs. Bellboy. She's married to Bellboy. Yeah, Bellboy at the time.
Lovely couple.
And he, he encouraged her to come back to Doctor Who because he'd had such a lot of fun on Greatest Show.
And, yeah, well, she gets that wonderful line about how she, you know, how she's happy that she's going to die because she's been smiling and it doesn't mean anything. Once you add in that dimension of the women who were used in that way.
It's a leap, but
it's antecedents. You know what I mean? And something else about the story, it's the planet of women again.
Ladyland.
I think Ian Levine was obviously right all the time. How it's going to end up.
That's it. Put women in charge.
Yes. Bras and guns.
But that's where I think the snipers are so good. And I've mentioned this.
Yes, the boys have the crap guns, don't they? Very small and grey things they are. Yes, and the guns.
Something I've mentioned many times on the podcast before, and I'll keep this brief. The Legend of Zelda series. In that series of games, the villain comes from a race called the Gerudo. And the story with the Gerudo is they are all women, except one man is born every 7 generations who will lead them. And in the...
Exhaustively, I can remember. Yeah. Poor bugger.
Well, that's the thing. You kind of look at...
Mind you, he'd die happy.
You kind of look at... Try and look at the logic of this. And it's like, if you have a humanoid species, which presumably involves sexual reproduction...
And parthenogenesis. And much as they cast show leaders for Doctor Who.
How does Ladyland work? So
the new name for this podcast.
So here, even though it is quote unquote Ladyland, you do see male characters and you see, if you like, the sexism inherent in this culture, and it holds a mirror up to the sexism of our culture.
Yeah, yeah.
The mask.
Because this is also about masks. No, you get to do Zelda, I get to do Oscar Wilde. Because this is also about the false face and exactly what Helen A. and Thatcher was doing at the same time. You know, in his essays, Decay of Lying, when he talks about masks being the obsession of image over underlying truth.
Yeah.
So, and I won't go into the quote again, but... You know, the mystery of the world is in the visible, not the invisible. Only a fool does not judge by appearances. It's wild. But that was also picked up by Franz Kafka in The Castle and the Trial, with the hero being Joseph K. Do you remember? Has anyone actually read those? Because something fandom talked about a lot at the time when this came out.
I read Metamorphosis years ago.
That's amazingly good. Mm. But the trial and it's what The Prisoner, the Patrick McGoohan show, was directly influenced by. But it's also very much this show. And that's where the Sigma characters and the
last initials.
KSP is directly from Kafka, yeah.
Yeah, and I like that the initials are explicitly ranks. Because
In case you missed it, isn't that? I think we should. Yeah. You had that at school, though, don't you?
Yes, we just call people by their initials.
But yeah, you've got Harold F being bumped down to Harold V. I think my favourite member of the Happiness Patrol is Priscilla P, who's guarding the waiting zone. But she's my prisoner. I captured her myself. She's so fast.
These girls are all babes, and it's wonderful that they were all dolly birds in the '60s and seventies themselves in lots of shows, and that whole thing of the Fuller's Earth makeup. You know the story. Only Leslie Dunlop was allowed to be pretty. And and the makeup artist who was...
I think it was Dorcas
Nrinzak. It was. I can never say her name because it's like the best round of Scrabble you've ever had where you can finally get all those letters onto the board and still win. Yeah, but she was using Fuller's Earth. Only Georgina Hale's makeup, she got a terrible rash because they couldn't get it off, to chip it off in the end.
Yeah, and I think with Georgina Hale, I have to mention for myself and James, she was a massive part of our childhoods in a show called Teabag.
Has anyone else seen that? It's not a term you can really use in polite company these days.
No, I wouldn't Google it.
Blossom's another one you shouldn't Google, children. Google that.
It was an educational program with a sub Bonnie Langford child called Kelly Bright.
Sub Bonnie Langford. Don't Google that.
Running around and collecting artifacts from poorly constructed studio sets. To make sure that the evil witch Teabag, who was obsessed with tea, she could make a cup of tea and see the future in it, didn't get her hands on it. Georgina Hale played the second Teabag. Elizabeth Estenson played the first one. And Elizabeth Estenson was incredibly sinister. You know,
did she get a little tear in her corner and then, you know, she just leaked everywhere and they had to replace her?
That's right. Whereas Georgina Hale brought a bit more comedy to it, but was still quite scary. And so...
Terrifies the buggery out of me.
And so she was Teabag at the same time as she was on this show. So I recognized her. You know, it was like kids in the early 80s being able to switch on the TV any night of the week and there's Peter Bloody Davison on five shows, none of which are headed by women. Thank you, Peter.
Ask Janet Fielding about that.
Yeah, so that was where I recognized Georgina Hale, who plays Daisy Kay. And essentially, she plays Teabag in the same manner as Helen A, really. Mm-hmm. So imagine Helen A chasing after a young child who's trying to collect the seven silver spoons of Atarak. It was that kind of show.
Say it three times, it's a big Finnish podcast.
Yeah, exactly. You'd love it, Nathan. It's basically the Keys of Marinus every single night. Just with a different artifact. What I love about these characters is, as you say, they are just... You can tell they are actually desperately unhappy. All of them are incredibly unhappy. Priscilla's unhappy because she used to be really good at her job and now she's manning the waiting zone.
Mm.
Daisy Kay is unhappy because no one takes her seriously. Mm. Susan Q is unhappy because her friends have been disappearing and she can't say anything about it.
Silas P is unhappy because he's only in the first episode.
Yeah. Mm. And again, you know, because he's a man, his achievements aren't recognized because Helen A says, oh, you know, you've found this many killjoys, and he corrects her and she's like, no, I do the counting.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it mirrors what happens to women in our own
you want
world.
To rise to the top, not the very top, I hate.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Richard, you alluded to this last season and it's something I only know secondhand. So I may start off, but please feel free to jump in and correct me because
you're much older.
But, you know,
so old.
Okay, so long story short, for those of you who aren't aware, late 70s, early 80s, gay men in America and in other places started dying from a mysterious new cancer that was affecting the homosexual community, later discovered to be HIV/AIDS. And part of the response to this by the Reagan and Thatcher administrations was to essentially do nothing. And the public line was pretty much these people have no one to blame but themselves.
Proper righteous indignation. And let's just throw in a little bit of Old Testament one-upmanship here as well. Mm. The churchy folk were quite behind doing nothing.
Yep.
So it was Nancy Reagan, her best mate in the whole world. You would think they certainly behaved that way. Rock Hudson. And I've got to tell you, a lot of people at the time Had held very little flame for Rock Hudson because he was in the closet till the day he died, almost the day he died. But he also brought it to prominence and became quite vocal, or at least his friends did, that he was personally, you know, calling Nancy and writing her letters and saying, please intervene, please get these drug trials going, please let us have medication. She just never responded to any of them.
Right. And Reagan was famous for just simply not mentioning it,
yeah,
like never bringing it up. And then you have, you know, the government being forbidden from promoting homosexuality. Like, was it local authorities in Britain were forbidden from spending any money on the promotion of homosexuality at all?
Yeah, and promotion being safe sex, promotion being mentioning it exists, promotion being presenting it in any way other than a moral deviancy.
But it was also, it's very telling for the next catastrophe that we get, and how far away is that? They had no cure and they knew not how it passed. The first people to actually publicly touch an HIV/AIDS patient was not a member of any political organisation. They were both people in the entertainment industry and indeed near royalty. Elizabeth Taylor and Princess Diana were actually the first people to touch and kiss HIV on camera. On camera. Because we really didn't know how it would transmit. And there was a very real fear, as with other viruses, that it could become airborne. And it was Australia, of all places. We had no idea, but friends of mine, Paul Kidd was one of them. He was at uni with me in first year of architecture and then ran away. They talked about this, and he's been pos since, gosh, we were, you know, late teenagers and still with us, thank goodness. Australia was the first place to trial with condoms and actually issue them and saying this is the only way. We didn't know it wouldn't pass because the virus is so small and was so virulent at the time that we assumed, we didn't know whether it would pass through the membrane. But as it turns out, it worked.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
but yeah, that was only Australia doing that, not the UK and not the US.
Mm-hmm. So here, like, why is this story talking about that? So,
because of Thatcher's Clause 28.
No, I mean, what is it about this story that makes it about HIV denialism, do you think?
Well, the moment in particular for me is the execution of the man by Fondant Surprise in episode one.
Who is Cytown, who is an openly gay actor.
Mm-hmm. And a Dalek operator.
And, yes.
Occasional Dalek.
So he's not wearing a pink triangle badge, as is famously written about.
No, he's wearing
in Phantom,
a pink shirt.
Underneath a black chevron
which makes
a triangle. Pink triangle. And that pink goo, it's telling, isn't it? Mm. Yeah.
But and I think it is also because of the campness of the story.
Because he's emitted out of a giant tubular sphincter.
But for me, the moment is when he is executed for public grief.
Yeah.
Because nothing was being done in the States or the UK about HIV, which meant if your boyfriend died from AIDS, well, you shouldn't be sad about that. It's exactly what he deserved.
Yeah.
Grief in the gay community was seen by the authority as, well, that's not a legitimate emotion. Your love wasn't legitimate to begin with, so why should we acknowledge your grief? And as much as the fight was on to get actual medical treatment happening, there was also the fight for that recognition of these are people who are dying. And that is part of what this story is about, because people in this story aren't allowed to mourn the dead, smiling while my friends were dying.
Yeah.
You know.
And it is, in fact, when Helen A. loses someone and actually does her own ostentatious display of public grief that, you know, the story comes round.
And Fifi only had life by having a fist up its backside. So I think there's something in it for all of us.
I mean, what also brings that round and makes this story superior to the Savages and the Sunmakers is that it shows its villain to be human. Even though the villain is Thatcher and we should feel no sympathy for her whatsoever.
She has no sympathy for herself nor anyone else.
Exactly.
Perfectionism, actually. That's the drug of choice that will bring down democracy, perfectionism.
Mm. Whereas here, the Doctor evokes feeling and sympathy for the devil. Because he is such a good character and a positive influence, he's not just saving the planet.
I think he and Ace stand by quite impassively while Helen.
This is the point. They're
that.
A mirror. So they are quite devilish. I'm with you on that
And remember,
because they merely reflect back, which you could also say is a very Aristotelian and then Marcus Aurelian, and then it comes in with some New Testament writers as well that Nathan knows better than I, such as Paul, that to teach others to do good, one cannot educate or enforce, because that kind of inculcation is just met with animosity. What you do is show.
Mm.
Show, don't tell.
I think the really telling thing is in episode one, Ace says she wants to make them very, very unhappy, and that's what they end up doing. And in fact, Helen A's obsession with happiness actually makes her completely unable to deal with the revolution that takes yes. place, because she can't even accept that it's happening.
Mm. And perfectionist pursuit of an ideal that can never be.
Yeah, it's her scene yeah. with Daisy Kay, where she's packing a case and she cannot admit that the whole thing has gone to hell, because that would be being unhappy.
That she was saying that of Pinochet at the time, a Chilean dictator who'd killed millions of his own people, and she was offering him sanctum.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the scene that leads up to Helen A's breakdown, where she's walking along and Sylvester steps out of the shadows. Mm. And, you know, it's conducted with depth of field. And the shock on her face, the incomprehension of what went wrong. She's one of the most evil characters in Doctor Who ever, because she genuinely believes she's doing the right thing. If you look at who we probably held up as the best villain from the Colin Baker era, Syl knows he's causing suffering and doesn't care. Whereas Helen A genuinely thinks she is doing right by the people. She's not, of course, but the
fact... She's pursuing the ideal that she grew up with, just as Thatcher's father was a martinet that, you know, imposed strict discipline on her on her little... Oh, it's so Jackie and Joan Collins, isn't it, living above the shop. So she grew up, yeah.
Yeah, but, okay, I get what you're saying about, like, the Doctor and Ace stand by and force her to be unhappy, but at the same time, I think they stand by and allow her to be unhappy. She needs to go through breathing that emotion space, herself.
Yeah. Unlike this podcast.
And the point there is, of course, that Ace actually wants to step in and help. Ace says, can we do something? And it's the Doctor who says, we've done it. This is what we've done. Love. And I think it's also important, because there are a few Doctor Who stories where the villain sort of gets their comeuppance and the Doctor's not there. You know, the Doctor sends them off with a bomb or something, Graf Vindicae. This is a story where the Doctor stays to watch the consequence of his actions upon the villain. He does it with Davros in Remembrance of the Daleks as well. He will do it in Silver Nemesis, and he will do it in The Greatest Show in the Galaxy.
Mm.
And I think
there's
that's
a theme emerging here.
Yeah, well, I think he's teaching Ace the importance of, you know, if you're going to take an action, you have to stand by and see the result of that. You have to accept responsibility for that.
I wanted to say that this story has my favourite cliffhanger in the entire classic series, and that's the "oh dear, doesn't look like Daphne S went down too well now, does it?" cliffhanger, which I just think is brilliant. It's so clever. It's got, I think Priscilla P comes in and paints R.I.P. over Daphne's painting.
Yeah.
And then you get the music, of course, sells it, the framing of the shot.
Yeah.
You've got Sylvester standing there. You've got Ace helplessly just trapped in a photograph, you know, in peril. It's just word peril.
Yeah, Dr. Mabuse, or M, as it was remade by Fritz Lang, which was an example of Weimar filmmaking.
I thought you were going to say that.
No, it actually is. It's the same. It's a similar scene. And yes, very much so. And the very Weimar, dark humour, because we've just gone through a war with soldiers returned with missing limbs and such like. And that's kind of what this all felt like. Every era is like this, if we just acknowledge it.
Speaking of episode endings, I really like the final scene. But so, of course, we have the emotional ending, which is Helen A with Fifi. But then we have the scene with Daisy Kay and Priscilla P repainting the TARDIS.
And suddenly the Pipe People, who, again, we haven't really talked about this, but there's an imperialism as well, that this society is built on excluding a whole class of people and taking their stuff. The Pipe People...
The Alpidae. Can we name check them? The Alpidae. Alpidae, if you want to put it that way. ALPIDAE. That's what they're called in the book.
Oh, okay. Yeah. They're, you know, an indigenous population that's being oppressed.
Of the children with gruff voices.
I think they're really
they're
cool.
They're played by little kiddies.
Gordon!
But they get brought in, and so you've got this sort of motley group of people who are...
tiny rodent like Adrian Edmonds.
But they're a group of people, a strange group of people who are now going to go off and try and build a proper society. Mm. I think it's nice.
Yeah, and Susan Q and Earl Sigma, who we haven't really mentioned, another black character in Doctor Who is a medical student.
And not with a trumpet. I think we're all a bit relieved. Yeah, that's how he was written.
And actually plays the harmonica very well.
Yeah, although they don't actually use it. He can actually play it, but he wasn't used in...
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's not him playing it.
Dubbing
him. God, it's gorgeous, isn't it? Yeah, it's beautiful. And it's also very New Orleans, the set design.
Yeah.
Reflects the...
And he and the Doctor communicate with each other across town using jazz, which presages next week as well. Yeah. But yeah, he and Susie Q walk off arm in arm at the end. Yeah, and
they do that fabulous film noir scene when they're standing over Priscilla P tied up in the waiting zone. Remember?
Yes,
and Helena switches on the screen and it's fabulously noirish.
Yeah, absolutely. And that last scene really embraces the Doctor's concept of you cannot have happiness without sadness, because Priscilla P and Daisy K are making jokes.
I'm glad you are happy, Daisy.
Yeah, exactly. The Doctor and Ace are happy and they're repainting the TARDIS, and Susie Q wanders off with Earl. So even though there has been all this sadness, there is then happiness. When the drones come into Forum Square and start partying, they are genuinely happy because they've been told, actually, there is a revolution happening. And they're like, finally! You know, even though they've come there out of a place of sadness, it becomes happy. And, of course, the Doctor points out, hey, Twisted Logic, you're the Killjoys now, Happiness Patrol, because you're trying to stop a party.
Mm.
It's, again, a very British thing. We touched on that in the last podcast, is that, yes, it's by not saying what you intend.
Yeah.
A nod and a smile.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, at the end of the last story as well, in that funeral scene, Ace says, did we do good? And the Doctor doesn't say yes or no. He just says, look, well, we just have to see how the situation bears out. And they do leave after that, but, you know, you kind of think off camera they had to have talked to Mike's mum, and they've spoken to Mike's friends, and they've gotten to know Mike's friends. They have stayed in the aftermath, but when they leave is the personal and private moment where his family are mourning. They allow them their space to mourn because they are outside of that. They are outsiders, and that's what the Doctor and Companion always are.
This is what I don't get about the show at the time, and in fact fandom now and the actors now. I'll just say it here because we're in the podcast and we're talking about this being the queer story, and, you know, we've got that arc in this season, is that Dursley McClendon, who was a secondary star in Follies, the Sondheim Follies at the time, and plays Mike Smith in this one, was Poz and did die not that long afterwards, and, you know, and pretty roughly, obviously, as well, because there weren't the drugs to treat him. No one references it. They just say, oh, yeah. They even on, you know, on the disc interviews, even stuff at conventions and everything else that I've looked at, it's never mentioned that he died of HIV/AIDS. It's not even mentioned that he was queer because, oh, he's dead, we can't talk about that. Yeah, we bloody should be talking about that. And I don't think he would appreciate that you're not talking about that, because there seems to be the whole shame thing. You died because of a sexually transmitted disease. Mm. No, you died because you are a certain type of person who had a certain type of life and it isn't exactly like yours, but you know what? You're next in line. So I wonder how much of your not agreeing to discuss me, I'm speaking now as McClendon, and my passion for having lost friends at this age, at this time when this was going out, actually, I'm really not happy about the fact that we, as fandom, and indeed as show people who are in the show, don't mention this and don't discuss this.
Well, that's
all we've got. All we've got is podcasts now to talk about.
Well, that's why, even though, as I said earlier, I didn't live through this. You know, I was born at the height of it. But when I was at university and I was going to queer student conferences, where I learned so much about this, there was a documentary screened at one of these conferences. I can't remember it. And, you know, so we had an auditorium full of uni students, and about half of them left during the course of the documentary because they didn't see how it related to them. And it was about the AIDS crisis. And I remember at the end, I haven't seen him for many years, a young man who was big in the Sydney leather scene at the time got up and he just said, I want to say to all the people who've stayed, thank you. Mm. I accept that a lot of people our age don't know much about this. This is my address book. So this was before smartphones. He said, this is my address book.
Yeah.
This is my third address book in 10 years because I keep having to throw them away.
Mm. That was happening, yeah.
Yeah, and that's why whenever I talk about this story, I am so passionate about bringing this up. Even though I didn't experience it, it makes me so angry. And also, you know I have friends who go through. I have a partner who went through it.
Yeah, you know,
and I know that finding out about it after the fact and being angry about it after the fact is not the same as having lived through it. But I think it is so important that we don't forget what it was like then, the way the people who walked out of the documentary, they had the opportunity to learn what it was like then. And they've kind of gone, I'm 18, I'm 19, as I was at the time as well. It's not simply an age thing. This doesn't apply to me. And it's like, yeah, okay, maybe it doesn't apply to you now, but be grateful it doesn't apply to you now because all these people had to suffer to make sure it doesn't apply to you now.
Mm.
But yeah, that's why I am so passionate about this story. That's why I would probably say it is my favorite Sylvester story, because not only is it a good narrative in itself, it is social commentary. It is telling us to make our world a better place without punishing people who are not necessarily like, quote unquote, us.
And because it shows us what we do and who we are. And do you know, the other reason that I really love it is because it isn't just about an internal or internalized grief, which it always should be, and what the AIDS crisis was also about, showing us that this is also happening under every regime. We're having it happening right now. We don't talk about Rwanda. We don't talk, Bosnia and Sarajevo at the time was exactly this kind of thing. So I really, really love, I think the pinnacle that they've achieved is talking about personal grief within the UK and within the Commonwealth at the time is a mirror of what we were also sanctioning, indeed allowing, in these other nations, which is simply a dismissal of suffering and a dismissal of death. And that's the great cultural point that we need to start owning. And this show, a kids show that no one was watching, is being more of the moral arbiter and the greatest voice for consciousness that we were getting. My God, is Doctor Who really this good? Maybe it actually is.
Well, dear listeners, Paradise is a bit too pink for us, so we're taking off for a nice summer concert with Courtney Pine. Do come back next week for Silver Nemesis. In the meantime, don't forget, check our show notes for a link to vote for our Colin Baker commentary. Your choices are Mark of the Rani, Revelation of the Daleks, The Mysterious Planet, or Terror of the Vervoid, so do make sure you vote for one of those. Meanwhile, over on Bondfinger, we are about to get three quarters of the way through the Pierce Brosnan era of James Bond. Next week, we'll be releasing our commentary for The World Is Not Enough, with Pierce Brosnan, Sophie Marceau, Denise Richards, and Robert Carlyle, and Robbie Coltrane. It's actually quite a good one, in my opinion. That's over on Bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at BondfingerCast on Twitter. We, of course, are Flight Through Entirety, .sexy, Flight Through Entirety on Apple Podcasts and Facebook, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. Until next week, may your husband not run away with your chief confectioner. Thank you very much for listening. Good night.
Good night.
It's a sticky end, isn't it? Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Nathan B, Brendan J, and Richard S. Theme arrangement by Cameron L, logo design by Anthony W. This episode, This Neocon World, was recorded on the 22nd of July 2017. The next episode will be released on August 13. If you want to make us very, very unhappy, just hold a $120 million optional vote on whether this story exists or not. Okay, so I think that's done.
Hate the cars.
Chris Clough can direct traffic. I think we've said that before about Ron Jones. You know, they're sort of slow moving vehicles in a tiny studio.
Yes. Oh, dear.
Sophie was only allowed half a litre a day.